Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Soleri Report. Tonight, it is my pleasure to discuss with Dr. Joseph Farrell his new book. The name of the book is Microcosm and Medium. I can save you a lot of time. You need to go order it immediately. You can link to it from Joseph's website at GizaDeathStar.com. It's on mind control. The subtitle is The Cosmic Implications. Okay, Joseph, give me the exact title.
The Cosmic Implications and Agenda of Mind Control Technologies.
Right, and it is the single best book I have ever read on mind control. Not by a little, but by a lot. And for many different reasons. But one is it goes much wider and much deeper. It integrates much more, and it pulls no punches on the importance and the power of the human mind, as well as the profound implications of mind control, and helps you understand that this kind of technology has been with us for quite a long time. So the first thing I have to ask you before we dive in, Joseph, is why did you write this book?
Well, I had been intending to write this book for about 10 years and have been gathering material for that amount of time. So I had a massive amount of material. And then I actually started writing the book last year. And then I ran across, and at the same time I was researching the book on Rudolf Hess, and I ran into that episode between Hess at Nuremberg and Alan Dulles and Dr. Ewan Cameron, who is, you know, notorious and infamous for his involvement in the MK Ultra program, using a technique which he called psychic driving to try and erase someone's personality and build an entirely new one. You know, and he subjected people in the psychiatric hospital that he ran in Canada to all forms of what I regard as nothing more than medical torture. And I decided that because of that, I had to flip the order of the books because I needed to get the Hess information on record, but not comment very much about it. And then do this book as kind of a follow-up in a certain sense. But the other problem that created the delay was over those 10 years I was planning to do this book and gathering materials, I kept noticing that everybody who's written on mind control is narrowly focused on the technological aspects of it, the hypnosis aspects of it, and they're really not delving into the underlying cosmology or metaphysic or philosophy, whatever you wish to call it, that's behind it. And if you look at that cosmology, part of the problem is it creates a grounding, a metaphysical grounding for the arts and for media. And I always had the assumption that mind manipulation itself was going to concentrate not just on the technologies that everybody else talks about with mind control. It's going to concentrate on much subtler and softer forms of it, like the arts, like music, architecture, sculpture, literature, and so on. So I wanted to integrate that into the book, and the difficulty there was, in order to do that, I had to go into what I think is the cosmology behind those things, and then show how the whole modernist movement in the arts has literally been driven by people with an agenda to uproot people's connection to that ancient cosmology and ground them in something entirely different. So the book was very difficult to write for that reason, but that's why I wrote it in the way that I did.
You know, people always ask me, why should I go into this topic? Because it's so gruesome and so mm-hmm. depressing. And mm-hmm. one of the things I always tell them is you should go into this topic and go through all the gruesomeness and all the depressingness, because what you'll find at the end is an incredible amount of understanding about how powerful the human mind is mm-hmm. and how if we break through this obstacle, you know, we really can turn it around.
Right, right. And that was the other aim of the book is to show that these techniques and technologies have been around for a very long time. They didn't just spring into existence in the 20th century. These techniques and things were known for centuries, particularly in the arts, but they were used in such a fashion because the cosmology underlying it was an integrative cosmology. The result was you had people that were, as you like to call it, coherent people. They were not afflicted right. with clinical dissociative disorders. Well, the thing that has happened is when the cosmology was jettisoned and rejected right around the 18th century, in its place was placed a cosmology that was dissociative. In other words, it split the human person from the human nature. And this I spent a great deal of time in the first two chapters of the book showing how, particularly in the first chapter, trying to show how the CIA in particular was driving the modernist school in all of the arts to create this dissociative state. So in other words, they're literally driving a form of art into the popular culture, and for that matter, into what remains of the high culture, to create a situation culturally and civilizationally where people are in that constant dissociative state, and therefore they're running from one thing to the other, and they're not trying to seek any metaphysical ground for their existence. And the problem there was that this was done in the context of the Cold War to show, they were promoting, to give you an example of what I'm talking about, they were promoting actively the splattering, dripping nonsense of Jackson Pollock, his so-called art, and I don't think art at all. It's just it's finger painting, and they were promoting artistic work like that in order to show that the West had complete freedom. Jackson Pollock was an avowed communist, so here's the CIA promoting an artist, and I'm using that term extraordinarily loosely, to show that, the artist has full freedom in the West, even if that freedom ends up as a kind of antinomian rage against any existing artistic or cultural order, as is the case in Pollock's so-called art. Whereas the Soviet artist had to work under strictures of, socialist realism and all of that. And oddly enough, what that meant was that artists in the Soviet Union had to adhere in some form or fashion to the artistic traditions that had preceded them. So, you had composers like Shostakovich or Prokofiev in the Soviet Union that were producing amazingly good compositions. And, they're easy to listen to. They're very pleasurable to listen to if you like the modern style of that type of music. But, the West is promoting the ugliness of Arnold Schoenberg or Alban Berg or Stravinsky or Pollock and people like this to demonstrate perfect freedom. Well, it's an antinomian freedom. It's a freedom without any restraints. It's a freedom, and it's an art that basically is a kind of rage against all existing order, including human order and human beauty. So it ends up being utterly nihilistic in the long run, and it ends up being anti-human as well as unhuman. So, I cast a very wide net in this. It's not to say that I'm not concerned with mind control technologies. I spend a great deal of the book examining those things. But I want to show that art is a part of it, that this is one of the principal ways that they have had and used to get to
people.
Well,
I thought when you and I first started to talk about this, I knew you were right, but I didn't really fully understand the issues related to music and art and basically the human mind as it connects to the cosmic or the divine mind. Mm-hmm. And I thought you did an absolutely brilliant job in the first part of the book of explaining that. And it's the kind of thing to really understand. I would recommend people read it several times because it's unbelievably important. I was stunned because I had never heard from you the story of the researchers who could learn French a lot faster. when they were, but what they're really doing is disconnecting the human mind from the cosmic mind and fracturing the human mind.
Right.
And
exactly.
I think and the power of what you're talking about is, you know, basically when you think about it, the puppet masters are using their ability to manipulate our mind to get our mind to create the world they want.
Exactly.
And when, right. And when you see it, when you finally get through all the gruesomeness and you see it, you realize, oh, we can do that too.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
We can. Exactly. Yeah, we can. If they can weaponize our minds, we can too.
Yeah. If they can weaponize, you know, precisely, if they can weaponize the mind, if they can weaponize the arts, then we can too. And this is why I keep telling people, you've got to own the culture. In other words,
yes.
You know, if I can put it bluntly, you know, if there's any musicians out there in American graduate music schools, you will know exactly what I'm talking about, because they're trying to teach you to compose in some form or fashion according to the dictates of modernism, and therefore produce crap that no one wants to listen to. Well, I'm just saying, just say no. Just say no.
So I wish you could have been...
Go ahead. Well,
I wish you could have been with me. You go.
Well, what I'm getting at here, and what I say in the book is that the cosmology grounds a certain approach to any of the arts. And we have to understand that in that cosmology, this goes all the way back to Plato. It's not something that's uniquely Christian, although it was Christianized in a very deliberate, thought out way from, you know, during the Middle Ages, during the Renaissance, and culminating in the Baroque era. But what I'm trying to get at with people owning the culture is, be aware of the cosmology that undergirded the flowering of this culture up to the 18th century, and be aware, therefore, of the cosmological shift that occurred in the 18th century when things began to break down. And once you're aware of that, then you're armed in such a way that you can combat it. And I would say this is particularly true of people in the arts. You know, I'd much rather listen to the Beach Boys than so-called modern classical composers, because the latter have been nothing but drivel and ugliness. And it's time to call them out. These are sacred cows that are witless, talentless loons that have uglified our existence and driven this dissociative psychological state. And, you know, I'm elevating the arts to a very high position because, again, this goes back to Plato. The artist was conceived in this cosmology as occupying a central place in the ordering of society. And the reason why was that the artist was trying to represent and recreate the cosmic divine order that these people believed in and thought existed. And I think they were right. You know, it does exist. And we've moved away from that, and we've got to make the conscious choice to move back to it.
Maybe if you could just say a few words. You talk about the doctrine of affection.
Mm-hmm.
Your German's better than mine. You use the German term, but maybe mm-hmm. if you could just say a few words about that.
Well, the Affektenlehre was a doctrine in the arts that arose more or less during the Renaissance. But it's actually older, but it begins to be called this. And what the doctrine is, and this is so very difficult for the modern mind to wrap itself around, the doctrine is that the artist, and in particular the musician, by using certain musical procedures, is trying to connect you with the universal human passions. Now, please note, I did not say that the artist is trying to communicate his or her subjective emotions. There's a difference, because what the Affektenlehre is trying to tell you is that your emotional responses to art are grounded in something much more universal they're grounded in the human nature itself and not in your individual subjective personal response. And they composed music, therefore, with this idea that certain very specific musical procedures could conjure your participation in those universal human passions, all right? In other words, they ground the emotional life in something bigger than the individual person. The romantic era aesthetic that begins to take rise after the cosmological shift in the 18th century is that the artist is, you know, sort of an original genius who is trying to communicate a very subjective intellectual and personal vision of the world. And this is the way that people have been taught to listen to music. And it's no wonder that in the modern age, if people listen to classical music, most of them tend to listen to the music of the Romantic era rather than things prior to it, because they're coming at that music with the wrong cosmology. Now, that sounds like it's a tall order, but I point out the fact that the doctrine of Effektenlehre survives in a kind of truncated, non-cosmological form in the music that's composed to accompany films. Or you could even think of music that you hear in political advertisements, where certain musical procedures are designed deliberately to create an emotional response in the audience that otherwise would not be there with just the film alone, or just the commercial advertisement about this or that political candidate alone. It's the music that's communicating something much more subliminal and objective. So the doctrine is still right there, but people don't realize that there's something going on here. And, you know, I originally, Catherine, was going to make that chapter in the book much more detailed and actually get into analysis of a couple of pieces of music just to show people. But I thought, no, that's kind of overkill. But I've been performing an experiment with some friends of mine, having them listen to pieces of music and tell me what their responses to it are. And it's been breathtaking. The accuracy of these subliminal effects that are built in deliberately into the musical pieces that I've had them listen to, and what their response has been. So it's definitely there, and it's a very, very deep rabbit hole. I want to caution people that when you get
right, it is a deep rabbit hole, but I think it's a very important rabbit hole, and yeah. It leads you to understanding what it takes to create integrity in many different areas, mm-hmm. you know, starting with music and art and culture, but it keeps going. You had a wonderful quote from C.P. Bach, mm-hmm. Because it was, you know, I kept hearing this, the words from scripture, where two or more are gathered mm-hmm. in my name, there am I. But, mm-hmm. you know, it was this wonderful quote from C.P. where he's talking about how the artist truly has to, you know, be personally involved in, and he doesn't use the word channeling, but I'll use the word channeling, those, you know, those passions. So there has to be an integrity
right.
in the artist in,
right.
in reaching, connecting, and bringing forth those passions. So it's not as though the artist is just a tool. It's, you know, it's the difference between accessing and communicating the, you know, the greater cosmic reality, as opposed to throwing up your personal stuff.
Well, exactly. And one of the key things here right. about the doctrine, the Effektenlehre, is that the composers at that period literally were trained to observe the responses of people to their painting or to their music, and observe them very carefully and closely. In other words, if I do this, will it produce that? In other words, it gets down to some very, very nitty-gritty detail. This is not just a wishy-washy make-believe.
And
right. what that says is something very important. And it goes to intentionality. The artist at that period had a specific intention to to convey certain specific things, all right? And intentionality, in turn, if you look at it, is ultimately behind all of the psychic research that went on in the Soviet Union, in this country.
Right.
It shows up in the work of Dr. William Tiller that I mentioned in the book that you brought to my attention. And that intentionality, I want to be very clear, is very formally, specifically specified in a written out statement. And you find this, particularly during the High Baroque era, you find this intentionality encoded in the music in ways that you just would not believe unless someone sat down and pointed them out to you. It's really rather amazing. So this was not this was not the Romantic era composer sitting down and banging out stuff on the piano and scratching it down, you know, that sounded neat, and scratching it down on a piece of score paper. This required a lot of thought and a lot of preparation. And when you come for your visit, I'm going to show you something to show you how very detailed and deep this rabbit hole really is in terms of what's going on in the music.
You use a couple examples that give you the real sense of it in the book, and I thought that was very helpful. I really, 3 weeks ago, I was in the French Pyrenees, 2 weeks ago, and we went across into Spain to go visit the Salvador Dali Museum. He was from the Spanish Pyrenees, right next to the border, and the town where he grew up now has a very significant museum where he donated all of his works. And it was amazing because I'd never seen early Dali paintings. And Joseph, they're absolutely beautiful, totally coherent, very classic. What an incredible gifted artist. But then you go through the museum and you see the whole history of basically Dali shifting away into the surrealistic movement. But you... it's almost as though you're watching his mind be fractured.
Yes, exactly.
And it had never occurred to me that the CIA had gotten a hold of Dali and done things to him. But watching the sort of the flow of all the paintings from the young to the, you know, to throughout his career, you wondered, you know, is he simply documenting the fracturing of the human mind? Or is his mind being fractured too? I don't know what the truth is, but it's literally documenting the process by which the CIA and the covert forces fracture the human mind. And he document, you know, if you look at his life work, it documents the whole thing, everything you've been saying. I was almost tempted to call you from the museum and try and, you know, snap pictures and...
Well, you know,
but then I realized, oh, you're probably asleep.
The same thing holds true of Pablo Picasso. If you look at very, very early Picasso paintings, they're done in a very neoclassical style. They don't look anything at all like his later Cubist period. And Cubism, as far as I'm concerned, is yet another fracturing of the mind. Because, again, you're presented these slicing shards of chaos, you know, that really disassemble and fragment the human subject itself that he's, you know, that he paints. So the art is reflective of what's happening in the broader culture. And my point is there is absolutely no reason or no excuse that we have to slavishly follow these emperors without clothes and produce works of ugliness. Absolutely none whatsoever. Right. In our architecture, you know, everywhere. And even, you know, even Prince Charles in Great Britain commented years ago about the ugliness of modern architecture. But, you know, the problem is people don't realize that this is coming out of a shift in cosmological viewpoints. And that's the underlying problem here. So that if you're willing to fragment the human mind in the arts, then you're willing to fragment the human mind with other techniques, you know, mind manipulation technologies and so on and so forth. It's all of a piece.
When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, we had a program for senior housing called 202. A lot of the churches would build senior housing, and mm-hmm. I was meeting with the staff, and I said, you know, this housing is so ugly, and from a financial standpoint, it would be more economic for the taxpayer if we made it beautiful, because if you look at what you need to do to make it attractive, mm-hmm. you know, it won't cost you any more money, and then the value of the property will hold better. It'd be better collateral. So
yeah.
Return on taxpayers say you ought to make it beautiful. And they said, oh, well, we can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why not? And Congress, they said, well, because this is not for wealthy people. And so we have to make it really ugly.
Yeah, well, precisely. In other words, only the high and mighty are allowed to have access to anything that contains
right.
a sense of transcendent beauty. The rest of us, you know, we'll give you rock music, you know, and this is the problem. We don't have a high culture anymore. It's dead. But I think it can be recreated. And again, I think they have deliberately killed it. This was the all-important emphasis by the CIA on trying to promote modernism in the arts. It's there.
Well, let me tell you, I've been tootling around Europe, going to organ concerts last summer and this summer, thanks mm-hmm. to your inspiration. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, it's there. You know, the folks are showing up. They're
yes.
packed.
Yes. I ran across a video on YouTube of a performance of the first movement of one of my favorite 19th century composers, but still a man that's grounded in that earlier cosmology, a fellow by the name of Jean-Marie Vidor. And it was a performance of the first movement of his Fifth Symphony for organ in a church in Rotterdam. And that church was packed with people.
Yep, last year it was all over Italy. This year it's all over France. It's packed, packed, packed.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. people are jumping up and down and cheering. You know, I'm telling you, there's enormous enthusiasm.
Well, now, people are tired of the ugliness. Yeah, they're tired of the ugliness.
Yeah. Yeah, their beauty is necessary for survival.
Yes.
The one thing I wanted to say, when you were a kid, did you ever get dropped from a seesaw? When you're on a seesaw and the person who's on the bottom part gets off and lets yours fall and crash to the ground?
Oh, sure. Yes, absolutely.
And the wind gets knocked out of you?
Right.
There were a couple times that happened both in the first part, which we're talking about now in the second part, but there are a couple times when I felt like I'd been dropped from a seesaw and I just had to get up and walk around and think about it and lie down and say, how could I not know this? How could I have not seen this? You know, I've been talking to Joseph. I should have seen this. And it's got this book, and the reason I said it's the best book I've ever read on mind control, is it's got, you know, throughout the book, it's got a series of deep, unique, creative, unbelievably powerful insights that just took my breath away. And that's why I say, and I can't describe it. You got to read it yourself, because it's, as you said, it's a deep rabbit hole, and you have to go through it. So let's turn to part two, mm-hmm. And I'll just start off with my biggest drop from the seesaw. You know, I'd known about Dulles and Cameron with Rudolf Hess,
mm-hmm.
but I really had never focused. You know, I thought the Nazis used entrainment, because if you looked at their big rallies,
yes,
you know, it clearly looked like they were using entrainment.
Yes.
So I had assumed they had, but I don't know why, I'd either forgotten or didn't realize that Rudolf Hess at Nuremberg tried to explain
yes.
that the leadership of the Nazi had been subject to mind control and entrainment.
Right, right. This was the discovery that I ran across when I was writing the Hess book at the same time as I had started to write this one. And Hess was attempting at Nuremberg during a period of the tribunals to make a statement about this. And the British judge cut him off. And he was unable to finish the statement. And of course, everybody thought that the guy was loonier than you know. But really what Hess was saying was that, you know, this was the first modern example of a mass movement that had been manipulated into existence through mind manipulation techniques and technologies. That's what he was saying. So in other words, he only predated the American concern with it after the Korean War by a very few years. So what he really did was he pushed the beginnings of this back to the war itself. And the thing that clinched it for me is when Alan Dulles shows up at Nuremberg with Dr. Ewan in right. tow to interview Hess, because Dulles already has the sense, and I'm sure he's getting it from some intelligence from somewhere, that he may be dealing with a double that had been implanted, so to speak, with a double personality, with a Hess personality, so to speak. And I go into that whole thing in the Hess book in much more detail than I do in this book. But I point out, yeah, go ahead.
So here's why I really, this was a drop the seesaw moment for me, because in the 90s, when we passed, you know, when we created the WTO, mm-hmm. I'm sitting in Washington, and the world is absolutely going nuts. Now, when you have a movement of money that is that big, mm-hmm. you know, you get those kinds of – because the whole morphogenic field turns and goes in another direction, and mm-hmm. it's like a herd stampeding.
Right.
Because there's so much money, and everybody's in a state of greed. And I always thought it was a state of complete greed, although there were some loony things going on, because – when the $59 billion started to disappear from HUD, I couldn't get anybody interested. They're too busy talking about Monica Lewinsky's blue dress, and it used to drive me crazy. Mm-hmm. But you could see, as I was thinking about, you know, well, because Hess was smart as a whip.
Oh, yes.
You know, let's assume for a second that it was true. I'd always assumed that the craziness I saw in the 90s was simply the morphogenic field of the, you know, a big money turn.
Right.
But, you know, as I was sitting here thinking, Joseph, I realized, you know, it was much more compatible with a major mind control operation, because if you look at what we were doing, we were dropping SWAT teams in poor neighborhoods, rounding up innocent kids and just mm-hmm. stuffing them into prison. And it was all being engineered by African-American attorneys working for the Clintons. So Eric Holder, mm-hmm. you know, and all those folks, mm-hmm. and who all scream about them being progressives. And basically, they're running Nazi slave labor camps.
Yep.
You know, with some pretty sophisticated financial engineering, but that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And everybody was acting like it was just fine.
Yeah.
And when I look back on it, I think, you know, what if it was mind control? Because that would make so much more sense.
Well, one of the things I talk about in the book is a fellow by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger, who wrote a paper that basically stated that it would be possible to entrain or modulate information into electromagnetic broadcast that could go literally around the globe. In other words, that you could literally
right.
you could literally create a mass of people that are mind manipulated and they don't know it. And the other thing that emerges from the technology that I get into in the book is that they have created essentially a kind of electroencephalographic dictionary by
right.
saying certain words and recording people's electroencephalogram and watching the waveforms when certain things are said or spoken or so on and so forth. So we're back to effect and narrative, because this is exactly what the composers of that era were doing. They were quite literally creating whole dictionaries. And I'll show some to you when you come for a visit to show you how specific this is, to conjure right. certain natural human emotional responses. And I say natural, not personal, okay? In other words, they're not aiming for individual communication. They're aiming to integrate the person and the nature again. Persinger actually creates the idea that with the use of these electroencephalographic dictionaries, because of the fact that every individual's electroencephalogram is uniquely different to that individual, you could modulate information in a global broadcast to in such a fashion that only one person or a group of persons with similar types of brainwave activity would be able to hear or receive the subliminal transmissions. So right. In other words, I think you're exactly correct. I think it's possible with this technology, because they've said it out there in their own literature, that you can modulate this technology and create mass movements or reactions to news and so on and so forth. So it's definitely a technology that exists.
If you look at the, and you go into a lot of the technologies, and we don't need to do that here. Everyone needs to get the book. But if you look at the technologies, I think particularly once they rolled out the smartphones, you uh-huh. now have relational database operations
yep.
that can use artificial intelligence and relational databases to simply, you know, harvest every individual one at a time, as well as a yep. variety of groups, and do it on a mass, highly cost-effective basis. I mean, if you look at the history of, you know, where we started in the Middle Ages, or it probably goes way beyond that, but and where we are now, the advent of the cell phone telecommunications and satellite telecommunications just means they can do it, you know, highly economically on massive scale.
Right. And let's add to this, because the technologies that they have rolled out, everybody with their individual smartphone, and we know the phenomenon, you know, we're in the grocery store line and somebody's at the checkout counter and they're not paying any attention to the cashier because they're too busy texting or taking a phone call. So in other words, we've rolled out technologies that dissociate you from the rest of human society. And again, right. this is the key thing for me, and this emphasis that I placed in the book on effect and matter, and that is that doctrine in its high practice during the 18th century was an integrative idea. In other words, they were trying to bring the individual and the human nature into harmony with each other. But what begins to happen in the 19th century, and particularly with these mind manipulation technologies, is that they're driving what I can only describe as clinically dissociative states into the broader culture. And that's why we see the culture breaking down. Everybody's hysterical. Everybody's nuts. Everybody's crazy. You know, Trump did this today, Mueller did that today, and on this goes. But this is coming as much out of a cultural and spiritual state as it is out of a political right. and theological one.
Well, they're trying to get everybody to resonate with the machine as right. opposed to resonate with the divine.
Right, exactly.
That's what I see.
Yes, right. exactly.
Now, we published several weeks ago a fantastic presentation called The Wave Genome by Ulrich Kronecker, who draws tremendously on the, and it very much dovetails with your book, I might add. So I would really encourage everybody to if they haven't listened to it, to listen to it as you read Joseph's book. But one of the things she does, she draws tremendously on Soviet research, as do you. You point mm-hmm. out that the Soviets have done phenomenal research in this area. And
yes.
reading it, you think, no wonder the West is afraid of the Soviets.
Yeah, exactly.
They know too much.
Yeah, exactly. They did phenomenal research, Catherine, in all areas of mind manipulation, from what we would consider paranormal or psychic research in telepathy to sped up learning techniques, which incidentally involved Baroque music, which I thought was... I thought, well, there you go. You know, that's the proof of the pudding. things like that to experiments in technological enhancement of these abilities or technological interference with them. So they were very thorough in their approach. And one of the things that really intrigued me, Catherine, about their research was that the Russians spent as much time with learning what the personality characteristics had to be for a person to function as a good sender of telepathic information and a good receiver of it. And they found some astonishing stuff. And one of the things that it comes down to is, again, people who are in dissociative states, people who are not personally grounded in the common human nature that we all share. In other words, that are in touch with themselves, so to speak, to use that old cliche. People in those states, in those dissociative states, could not function well,
right,
in these psychic experiments that they were conducting. So they were looking for coherent people. And, right, you know, I point out in the book that this may have been one of the chiefest confrontations to the materialist Marxist dogma of the Soviet Union itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, you know, you have such an effort to promote hypermaterialism.
Yes.
And all of this just flies right in the face of it. You know, I've always believed that telecommunications was somehow telepathic communications was a non-local phenomena through the divine mind.
Right.
And you get into all of that, and it's absolutely, that was another one of my, you know, seesaw moments.
Yeah.
Because you really dive into that. And as you know, you go on to the next topic, I'm like, no, go, keep going. Go deeper down the rabbit hole. Anyway, a couple things I wanted to mention, because the part two is called Hard Techniques and Technologies, and you go into many. And as I said, we're not going to go into them here, but one of my favorite things was there's a new phrase that I'm going to use from now on, which is called the Manchurian Patsy. Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, you know, this was again a discovery that the CIA made in its MKUltra mind manipulation program, was that they discovered that, try as they might to drive dissociative patterns of thinking and behavior into people, that at some very deep subliminal level, they could only get people to do their bidding if they presented something as being for the higher good or the greater good, and so on and so forth. And they discovered in that process that it was much easier to mind manipulate a person to become a patsy for an operation rather than carry out an operation.
Right. Right.
And, you know, I'm kind of gobsmacked, because we see so many examples of that in almost every false flag operation from the Kennedy assassination forward, that right, there's some presence of someone in these operations that is kind of a befuddled bystander that all of a sudden finds himself in the center of a maelstrom of controversy. And, you know, he ends up being the patsy for it. And the classic case there, as I get into in the book, is Sirhan, because it's clear, right, that this guy was mind manipulated, and it's clear that this guy was, right, a patsy. Right. You know.
He couldn't shoot multiple bullets from multiple directions all at the same time.
Well, this is the other problem.
There are a couple other people I wanted to touch on, but we don't have to go into them. I was so glad to see your descriptions of Tiller's research were excellent, but I was also glad to see that you touched on John Hall and Gloria Naylor, because I, yes, think those are two of the more fascinating, mm-hmm, writers who've tried to expose some of what's going on with the technologies and the techniques.
Well, I have to thank you for putting me onto those two, because a lot of what... a lot of what I discovered by way of using their bibliographies were some of these very, very obscure areas of mind manipulation research, like, you know, what I'm calling the electroencephalographic dictionary, which, you know, there's no other word for it.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And
yeah,
they go into this. So yeah, Dr. Hall and Gloria Naylor, I read their...
Well, here's what you...
Go ahead.
Here's what you feel, Joseph, reading this book. You feel as though something has just taken a huge step up.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you talk, another one of my seesaw moments is when you talk about the fact that, you know, the wave that comes your way can be sent back.
Yes.
You know, two can play this game, and dueling minds and dueling intentions. And,
right.
But you get the feeling that enough people have written and dug and shared and whatever, that somehow with this book, you are finally upping our game into, you know, turning this around is the only way I can describe it.
Well, my point with spending so much time with Tiller and with Naylor and with Dr. Hall is precisely that point, that people need to start realizing that they can formally specify intention. And so much the better if it's a group of people agreeing upon an intention, and so much the better if those people are coherent and then directing that intention against these people that, and, you know, by name.
Right.
And directing right. intentionality against these people, you know, and I point out the fact that in the biblical Psalms, you have example after example of that sort of thing.
Yep. Yep. So, that's absolutely true.
And, you know, it's classic mirroring, you know, okay, if you're going to do this to me, I'll do it right back. you know, my goal in the book was to show people that you're not helpless, that mind manipulation technologies right. have surrounded us for all of human existence. And it's simply a matter of recognizing them. And it's a matter of turning off the ones that are producing the incoherence and promoting the ones that are promoting the coherence. It's that simple.
Right. And there's no doubt that we can each individually make yes. sure we try and live our lives so we remain coherent. But right. the other thing is, I think every time one of us goes to sit down and stare at a Rembrandt or goes to an organ concert or, you know, whatever that means. I mean, mm-hmm. this book finally totally integrated the cultural what, because when you first said we've got to preserve the culture, you know, the first thing I said being an investment banker is, well, what's my action? Mm-hmm. And what I've started to learn is, you know, every time I, you know, I go to the Vienna Philharmonic or I turn on, you know, Vivaldi and play Vivaldi so that it's streaming out of my windows, mm-hmm. you know, these are all little actions that, mm-hmm. that support and help the human and the cosmic mind.
Yes. I'm laughing because I used to have a car when I lived in South Dakota with a good stereo. And of course, you know me, Catherine, one of my big complaints is the ugly American driving around his city or town with the boom, boom, boom going in the speakers. And I pulled up one day outside of a doctor's office in South Dakota where I was living, and someone pulled into the parking lot with, you know, in a pickup truck with the boom, 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 and this ghastly, awful so-called music blaring out of the truck and sharing it for the world and imposing his bad taste on everybody else. And he turned off the truck, he went inside, and so I rolled down the windows of my car, turned up my stereo, and put on some CPE Bach and, and shared it with everybody. And pretty soon, much to my astonishment, out of the doctor's office comes the receptionist. And I had rolled my windows back up by that time, but I was still listening to the music and listening to it loud. And she knocked on the window, and I rolled down the window. And she said, I was expecting her to chew me out and tell me to turn the music down. No, what she said was, oh, thank you so much for that. What is it? Because we can all hear it in the office, and we, you know, and she kind of nodded toward the truck next to me that the guy had driven in. And she said, we get so sick of that here. So yeah, fight back. You know, if people are going to impose this ugliness on you, impose a little beauty on them. You know, I'm to the point that I've had it with having to accept every radio talk show has to have this god-awful blaring rock music for the bumper music. That's why I won't use it for anything I do. Start limiting what you expose yourself to in the arts or literature or television or film. And if it doesn't have some humanity in it, if it's exposing you to a constant stream of ugliness and scatological references and F-bombs, don't support them with your money. Turn it off.
Right. Right. Well, you know, I just spent two and a half, 3 weeks going through France and visiting cathedral after cathedral and hanging out with people who collect or love art. And it was, Joseph, I just felt like my, you know, I have a storehouse of beauty, and it's just all fulled up. Mm-hmm. It feels wonderful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it absolutely confirms everything you've been saying. And I mean, because I would never have done this if it wasn't for you. I'm off trying to figure out what the action is, right?
Well, that's the action. But exposing yourself to it.
Yeah. So, right. And supporting it.
Yes.
Because the more you support these things, the more they can thrive.
Right.
And what I've seen in Europe is it's just they're packing them in. When I went to see Mont Saint-Michel, we were driving towards Brittany. I was with Alistair Thompson. We came over the hill, and I saw it in the distance. And I just spontaneously went, oh, because it was so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And then we went, and it was a Wednesday. The Mass of the Assumption of Mary was mm-hmm. that day, and so mm-hmm. we attended. And it was just unspeakably beautiful. Of course, beautiful organ, everything. Mm-hmm. And it takes your breath away, but the place is absolutely packed.
Well,
thousands and thousands and thousands of people just pouring in.
This is another aspect of mind manipulation that I did. Originally, I was wanting to talk about, but I thought, no, I better just wait on that. And that's the liturgical uglification movement, as I like to call it, that began in the churches with Vatican II and then spread to the
Absolutely.
Protestant denominations. And as a result, the church is emptied out. You know, I mentioned doing an effect and letter experiment with one of my friends, and she passed it with flying colors, and was raised Roman Catholic and told me, you know, about her church that she grew up in back in the day that, you know, they were still doing the old Latin Mass. And then along came the new Mass, and the church emptied out. People just quit going. And that's what needs to happen. That's exactly what needs to happen.
Right.
Regardless if it's a church, a theater, an art museum, whatever, just don't accept the ugliness. Don't accept the mantra that change for change's sake is good. It isn't. Not all change is good, and particularly changes that are being very consciously and deliberately promoted. More than likely, they're being promoted by a bunch of modernists who want to dehumanize and anti-humanize the culture.
Right, and the reason they want to anti-dehumanize is because they want a lot more control of everything from your mind to your body to your money.
Yep.
I just need to mention this. I don't know if you realize, but Vatican II was also a process whereby central control of the assets was asserted in a way that a lot of them could be liquefied and moved into the stock market.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a real... If you don't control your mind, it's pretty soon before, you know, they're going to get into your pocketbook.
Right.
Well, I you know, I just have to tell you, this was an exceptional accomplishment. And well, I really think, you know, it has a wonderful bibliography as well. So if you're interested in deep diving on mind control, the bibliography is a great place to start. You've really covered all the bases. But the one thing I will say, Joseph, is I really think that you've upped the game tremendously on the whole topic. It's exceptionally important that we get this book circulating and read and discussed. And so I'm just going to ask everybody on the Solaria Report, I want you to buy this book. I want you to read this book. I want you to think about buying 10 copies and giving it to the people who – well, no, but if you – I go back to the issue of family wealth. You cannot protect or build family wealth unless you can protect and manage your own mind.
Yes, precisely.
You know, everything comes from this. And having been in Europe for several months, now I look back at America. You know, I prepare money and markets every week, so I'm covering the news. I'm talking to my team there. I'm talking to lots of people there. But I really – you look at America, and what you hear when you talk to people in Europe is America has lost its mind.
Yes, it has.
And I think the blowback from this much mind control and this much fracturing of the human mind is having unintended consequences.
Absolutely.
And we've got to get our minds back. And you can't get your mind back unless you understand that this crazy stuff exists.
Exactly. And I would go further. If you're trying to build personal wealth, make sure that you understand that wealth is not money or assets. It is those things, but the real repository of wealth is transcendent beauty. So I would tell people, make sure that you have some expression of this in your home, because it will subliminally cohere you. It will reintegrate you, your person with the human nature that we all share. And this is why this stuff is so pernicious, because they've been driving dissociative psychological psychopathic states into the culture, and we see the result. Nobody can talk to each other because the common bond, which is the human nature which binds us all, has been under assault. So that to me is the key component that's lacking here, is that we have to have a purpose for which we are building wealth. You know, C.S. Lewis said that things like friendship and art and beauty and so on are not anything that contribute to human survival, but they are things that make human survival worthwhile. And that's the problem. We've been operating with this materialistic culture, and, you know, we're miserable, we're unhappy. And there's a reason for it, because we're surrounding ourselves with ugliness, and we're permitting the society to surround ourselves with ugliness.
Right. I couldn't agree more. So after many years of trying to follow up on your suggestion that we have to own the culture, I finally understand what you mean.
Yep.
And Joseph, I want to thank you for your patience.
Well, thanks. Thank you for having me back on.
Okay. Before we close, let's talk a little bit about how you get the book. We can come to Giza Death Star.
Yeah.
We can also sign up for Giza Death Star. You're taking memberships.
Yep.
We can link, you've got the book listed in the book section. We can link and buy it from all the usual sources. Anything else?
Well, the book is a self-published book on Lulu. So if you go to the homepage of my website, over on the right-hand page, there's a picture of the cover. Underneath it, it says new book is available on Lulu, and that'll take you right to the Lulu link. The reason I did the self-published book, Catherine, is that this will permit me to do audio versions of the book, and I've already recorded the first chapter, which
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, will be getting up as soon as I got enough of the book recorded. And it's probably going to be on a platform where people will pay to download it and have access to it permanently. So, but the book itself is available on the website. It is not on Amazon. It is not published by any of my usual publishers. This is the first book I've done that way. I'm tired of the publishers getting most of the money for my work. And so this was a bit of an experiment. I had a magic threshold in my mind that if the book sells a certain number of copies, I'll probably go ahead and do all of the other books that I write in the future this way. So it hasn't crossed the magic
threshold. Well, the book is very nicely done. You know, I ordered it in the United States, and then I asked Robert to order it here in the Netherlands so I could read it when I got back to the Netherlands from France. And it came right away. So, you know, if you're in Europe, you can, you know, I think they distribute it from a European base. I'm not sure.
Right.
But it's easy to get in Europe. It's easy to get in the United States. I'm sure it's easy to get in Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. So,
yes, it is.
The books, yeah. So, and please let me know as soon as it's available in audio, because I know a lot of our subscribers like to listen when they're driving to and from, you know, when they're commuting to work or road tripping. So
right.
I want to make sure, but I will tell you this, if there's anything I or the Soleri Network can do to promote this book, I just think it's going to make a huge difference in terms of bringing this topic to a place where not only people can understand what's going on, they can deal with the gruesomeness of what's going on, but then they can see the power of what they can do. And
right.
So I think this is going to be one of your really big hits, this book.
Well, I hope so. I hope so.
Hey, intention is everything, right?
That's right. That's right.
So I want to get more of a commitment from you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, yes, go out and buy the book, folks. Buy hundreds and thousands of copies.
You're willing for this to be a huge hit.
Yes, I'm certainly willing for this to be a huge hit. Yeah. I'm a capitalist.
Okay, well, Joseph. Joseph, this really is an incredible contribution to freedom and the future. So again, thank you. And I look forward to seeing you in September when I'm back.
All right. Have a good trip and good vacation over there.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.